Hello, and welcome to the sixth installment of my podcast, Walking the Path with Rita Milio, Spiritual Sherpa and Holistic Wellness Coach. In my last podcast, we completed our deeper dive into the specifics of the six steps and stages of the spiritual path process. Today, we will look at some of the challenges that you may encounter as you journey forward. I call this podcast Detours, Potholes, and Other Challenges You May Face While Walking the Path. Choosing to walk the spiritual path is truly a commitment. This commitment comes with great rewards and it impacts your life exceedingly in very positive ways. But the journey is not always easy. There are challenges and difficulties to be faced and overcome. My intent today is to prepare you with the knowledge of some of these challenges in the hope that by being forewarned and having some insight into how others have faced similar challenges, you will find yours easier to navigate. I place these challenges into two categories, detours and potholes. We'll start by looking at some of the examples of path detours. These include commitment anxiety while living the dual life, busyness blues, and false opportunities. These challenges create detours because they tend to pull you away from your path, diverting both your attention and your energy into other areas of interest that may seem to be important and related to your path, but oftentimes are just distractions and attempts by some part of your subconscious that may be a little scared or intimidated by the magnitude of the task you're undertaking, or they may be attempts from what I call opposing forces to hinder you as a light worker from being able to provide your spiritual service to the world. Let's look first at commitment anxiety while living the dual life. Living the dual life means that as a light worker who is dedicated to following a spiritual path, a lot of your daily activities, commitments, and responsibilities involve doing things that support this chosen life perspective. You likely spend time meditating and reflecting on spiritual ideals, and you make choices that support these ideals. Yet at the same time, you probably are a regular person as well. Very few light workers are monks, nuns, or other spiritual people who live a sequestered life away from everyday life. So in addition to your spiritual focus, you must also balance the other aspects of your life and your responsibilities to family, work, and community. In essence, you live in and must navigate two different worlds. That is why many of us may often need to take a break from our intensive spiritual focus and just live a normal life for a bit every once in a while. In doing so, we bring ourselves back into balance. It is a real challenge to integrate both our human and our spiritual natures. The truth of who we really are at the essential level is our soul selves, not our personality selves. Yet we live on this earth and in this time as humans with our personality selves or egos still holding the major grip on us. Currently, we are in transition. We are neither here nor there. We're not fully spiritualized, neither are we hopelessly blind to spiritual truths. We are in somewhat of a no man's land as we are evolving from one level to the next. So during this time of transition, we have one foot in each of two very different realms, the physical realm and the spiritual realm. Our task is to find the balance between being a human being and a spiritual being. So for now, we must make peace with what is called living the dual life. But understandably, sometimes it just seems more efficient to grease the wheels, reduce the friction, and make things easier. Early on, for instance, I was reluctant to accept living the dual life because it felt unsustainable and somewhat insincere, especially when my human or ego needs were being nourished. At this time, I was also experiencing commitment anxiety, which is a common predicament of living the dual life. I realized that living a spiritual life involved responsibility and commitment. I realized that I had been drawn to the spiritual realm so that I could do something, contribute something. But I also realized that by doing one thing, whether it be a secular or a spiritual task, there would also be something else that I would not be doing. What would I be giving up? And could I be okay with that? When we make choices, our subconscious mind, if not our conscious mind, knows that in order to choose one thing, we are out of necessity giving up the opportunity to make other choices. For everything that we bring into our lives, we must leave out something else. My personality self has always had a great many goals. During my career, I felt compelled to write a number of books and to take on many projects, all the while maintaining a marriage and a family. In addition, I was very dedicated to consciously and consistently evolving spiritually. As the years went by, I came to realize that I might not be able to accomplish all of my many goals, but which ones could I bear to leave behind unfinished? Such come-to-realize moments happen for many of us. You may have already experienced commitment anxiety related to balancing your personality life and your spiritual life, or you may be struggling to do so right now. And your moment, like mine, is likely to be met with initial resistance. It's natural for us to resist commitment. When making life-changing decisions that require us to travel through unknown territory, often seemingly alone, we feel the weight of such decisions very heavy on our minds. It is intense and scary. And even though we may share our lives with partners and families, we are alone in our spiritual commitment to our spiritual path. In the end, we walk the path alone. So our spiritual goals cannot be shared goals. They are unique to us, and they are unique for us. I recall a time when I faced this realization head on. My husband has never really shared my love of the metaphysical, just as I have never really shared his love of golf. But occasionally I was willing to give up a perfectly good Sunday afternoon when I could be writing a reading and instead go with my husband out on the golf course and knock around a few balls. And likewise, even though my husband didn't really have much interest in such things, I could periodically relate to him how things were going in my spiritual quest. That is, until the day came when I couldn't. One day, after hearing that, yes, I did really believe in little spacemen, he simply turned to me and said, "Please don't tell me anymore." Such information was far too out of his perceived reality and out of his comfort zone. Not that he objected to me believing in what I believed in, nor did he want me to stop doing what I was doing. I should simply stop telling him about it. If he knew more, he would begin to look at me and wonder and worry. So from that point on, there was a hidden barrier beyond which he chose not to venture. And if I ventured there, it would be alone. I was devastated. I had tried so hard to bring my husband along with me, to coax him into becoming more interested in the metaphysical so that we could travel our paths together. I did succeed in getting him to be open to many new ideas, which he initially was not open to. He actually came to carry a crystal on his keychain, and he does ask me to heal him when he's sick. He believes that I'm not making up stories, nor am I crazy or even eccentric. But just as I will never learn to love golf, I'm afraid he will never learn to embrace the metaphysical. Still, I will continue consciously and determinedly moving further along on my path, allowing and nurturing the growing merger of my regular self with my soul self, because for me, it is the only choice. And in moving forward, I knowingly and freely defer my personal will to the larger will, God's will. One of the things about the spiritual growth process that has always sort of amused me is that we are so often challenged to spend large amounts of time and energy striving to achieve something, only then to immediately be challenged to give it up and let it go as soon as we possess it. Much of our lives we spend striving to achieve self-esteem, a sense of our own unique identity, and we consider ourselves lucky if we ever reach that goal. Yet, almost before the sigh of relief can be felt, indicating that the struggle is over, and certainly before the bills are paid to the therapist, we begin to sense that this is not the end to it. We have not reached nirvana. There is more to do. And that more involves, paradoxically, letting go of that hard-won sense of personal identity that we just gained and allowing it to merge with the oneness of all that is. This might seem quite spiteful or mean, perhaps, if we were not certain in our own trust that the universe or God is not spiteful or mean or punitive. The simple truth is that in order to give something up, we must first own it. It is not possible to consciously choose to defer our own small personal will to a higher will, or to let go of our sense of individual power and instead trust a higher power, if we do not own these first. Still, it is always our choice. We are never forced, coerced, or shamed into denying any personality part of ourselves. We simply sooner or later come to desire to merge our personality self with our soul self. I believe that commitment anxiety is a part of our path testing. It prepares us for the truth to come, the truth that even though we each really are one with all that is, we each bring to the whole a unique perspective. We are our own unique facet on the jewel of life, and each of us alone is responsible for polishing and perfecting just that single facet. So though we are one, and even after we merge our personality selves with our soul selves, we still do maintain a certain individuality as well, and this is a paradox that only can be understood from a cosmic perspective. So we just have to trust that God knows what he's doing. And now as you ponder on this, let's take a look at the detour of busyness blues. This is really an avoidance tactic for people who get cold feet as they walk their spiritual paths. It works by allowing the person to convince themselves that they are just too busy to attend to their spiritual lives, like some people who find it difficult to find the hour it takes to attend traditional religious services once a week. Many spiritually evolved persons with a metaphysical bent complain that the time it takes to meditate or get into a routine with any other spiritual practice simply isn't available in their busy schedules. But in reality, it's simply a matter of prioritizing. If something is important enough to you, you will get it done. The problem is that we've been so programmed to expect that there are set time limitations for such spiritual practices. It's as if there was a magic number of days that are required in order to attain enlightenment, or perhaps a set number of clock hours required to renew our license to elevate our consciousness. But I personally don't think that's the way it has to be. More important than the amount of time spent in meditation, I think it is the consistency which we use the meditative process that matters. The mind works through pattern and association. Habits are easily formed. If you set up repetitive cues that tell your mind, okay, it's time to tune in and go into a deeper mental state, which is exactly what meditation does, then your mind quickly learns what is expected of it. In the beginning, it may require a bit more time to relax down, but generally, the more often you meditate, the more quickly you can enter the deeper states. And once you've achieved control over the creation of the mental state involved in meditation, then you can release yourself from some of the time requirements. Eventually, you should be able to meditate anywhere for any amount of time and receive good results. I've become able to meditate, if only for a few moments at a time, in places like airports, conference halls, and other places where thousands of noisy people are around. Once the ability to tune out your surroundings is acquired, it becomes easy to go into your own little inner world, no matter where the rest of the world is or what it's doing in relation to you. I call such inner moments or minutes mini meditations. These are quick, often spontaneous opportunities when you can simply refocus your attention inward and you enter a mentally reflective or meditative state and do so without anyone around you ever suspecting a thing, except that perhaps you may appear to be a little bit absent-minded or distracted. Actually, I do this a lot. People have come to expect a certain amount of distractedness from me, I suppose. I consider it an occupational hazard, but I can quickly reflect inward in just a few seconds to perhaps send light or healing to a person or a situation, to regroup and relax myself if I'm stressed, or to reflect on a question or problem using the extra information and guidance available to me from my subconscious mind just by tuning in. I also often do a short 5-minute mini meditation just before falling asleep at night, during which time I send healing to my family and loved ones, ask for any assistance they or I may need, and reinforce my intentions for world healing. This is another factor in the efficient and effective use of the meditative state, the capacity to use intention to your advantage. Intention is a mental state. It is probably the most powerful mental state you possess. It is through intention that you aim your psychic and mental energy. Intention acts like the rudder of a boat, pointing the energy of your consciousness in the direction you have chosen. If you simply intend to have an open mind, to relax very deeply and thus realign your energies, then your consciousness energy flows gently and quietly without any particular direction in mind. But if you intend to open up your mental floodgates to receive cosmic contacts, your consciousness quickly focuses and pinpoints its energy, setting up the parameters and mental states of mind that are necessary for creating such receptive communication links. Some people, however, do find that their minds resist relaxing and entering the lower brain states necessary for attaining a deep meditation. This usually occurs because they have an emotional layer or barrier which they must break through in order to get to those deeper states. As I've mentioned in previous podcasts, this is the mind's way of keeping the lid on all those unruly subconscious thoughts and emotions that feel threatening to the conscious mind. It's a protective maneuver whereby the conscious mind attempts to protect you from experiencing emotions or insights that might overwhelm you. In truth, it would be better to bring the material to the surface and deal with it openly in a straightforward way. But most of us don't choose that route, and unfortunately in such cases, we often wake up one day to find that all this stuff has become so strong and insistent in its need to be resolved that it's now taking any opportunity it can to break through to the surface of our consciousness. And one of these opportunities is during meditation. Sometimes on occasion when you meditate, you may find shadow material spontaneously emerging. But if you stay with the meditative process and don't allow these spontaneous and often scary eruptions to cause you to pull back into your outer conscious state, you will find usually beneath the surface of these scary images lie the very insights and understandings that you need to become aware of in order to resolve your issue. These two will spontaneously bubble up to the surface if you give them an opportunity by simply allowing and noticing what comes up rather than resisting or running away from any difficult material. You can also make a conscious effort to spur along this emotional healing process using guided imagery, chakra work, or other methods, either by themselves or with the help of a counselor or a facilitator. One final thought on the use of shorter meditations is that it matters not whether you meditate 3 minutes, 30 minutes, or 3 hours. If you're simply going to get right up out of your chair and go back to your regular routine, forgetting about what you just experienced and making no effort whatsoever to integrate the spiritual quality of the state you were just in into your everyday life. We're all challenged to walk our talk, and time has little to do with it. It does not matter so much the time it takes to attend to our spiritual needs or to nurture our spiritual natures as it takes a change of consciousness, a new mental mindset that realizes the importance of our spiritual lives. Once we see for ourselves the positive changes that come from holding this perspective, we naturally begin to move that perspective into our everyday lives more and more. Now, the final detour in the path that we will look at today is the false opportunity syndrome. We all become excited when opportunities fall in our lap. Heaven knows it's hard enough to go out and find opportunities, let alone stumble upon them without any effort on our part. So you can imagine how disappointed it is when we discover that some of these apparent opportunities may hide detours and problems instead. I had such an opportunity in my career as a freelance writer. Getting a really lucrative assignment is pretty rare and sometimes actually a big bonus. So when a job came my way long ago, which would relieve my financial worries for quite some time, I naturally jumped at it. Despite the fact that I did have that slight niggling, that little intuitive feeling warning me that there might be a cloud on the horizon. But with dollar signs in my eyes, I pushed the feeling aside. Soon enough, though, I realized the reason for the intuitive niggling. This job took over my life. Like a giant octopus, it had its tentacles in every area of my work, pushing everything else aside. I got behind on my personal work as well. I lost contact with my other editors, and I couldn't take on other smaller, easier jobs. This job, however, I came to loathe, and I couldn't wait for it to end. So much for golden opportunities. This opportunity proved to be a detour instead, as I had to work twice as hard later to regain my momentum. In that same way, sometimes we make quick decisions about our spiritual opportunities and later find that they served only to delay rather than to speed up our growth. One friend I know received an invitation to study with a psychic to learn how to channel or receive messages from guides or discarnate spirits. This friend had been moving along well with her own spiritual growth and she was meditating regularly. She was in touch with her spiritual personal guide and was beginning to get intuitive guidance about her life's direction. However, While studying with her psychic teacher, she was taught to call on other spirits, departed relatives and friends, etc., which she found fascinating and exciting. However, she soon found that as she was increasing her connection with these other spirits, her connection with her own personal guide was diminishing. Moreover, she felt that instead of continuing to progress spiritually, she was starting to stall out. My friend had inadvertently moved most of her spiritual energy to what we call the astral realm, the emotional energy level where both emotional energy and those discarnate spirits reside. This realm provides much fodder for mediums and readers, but for those who are interested in continuing to progress past their emotional barriers and keep going into the higher realms, it presents a problem. For in this astral realm, you can only move in a parallel direction if you are going to connect to those spirits and discarnate entities. My friend was unable to progress further upward until she recommitted herself to her own growth and chose to leave behind the astral realm with the channel spirits that existed there. Either kind of false opportunity, whether it be your regular physical life or your regular spiritual life opportunity, can detour you from your path by depleting your time and energy reserves or by thwarting your spiritual progress directly. You will be wise if you remain committed to consistently moving forward on your path and upward with your spiritual energies. That's it for the detours. So now let's look at some potholes to watch for while you're walking the path. Common potholes that you can fall into and possibly can cause you to stumble in your progress include recovery roulette and spiritual snobbery or one-upmanship. Let's look at recovery roulette first. The initial stages of the transformational process that is an important part of our path journey often coincides with one or more encounter experiences or psychologically therapeutic processes. Many of us find ourselves by working with a therapist or through the assistance of a 12-step program or another type of peer support group. The phenomenal success of Alcoholics Anonymous spurred the growth and development of other self-help groups, from Narcotics Anonymous to Overeaters Anonymous. 12-step programs stress giving up one's personal power, you might call that ego, and turning it over to a higher power. The belief is that hope for recovery lies in letting go and letting God, as each person perceives him. A lot of the success of 12-step programs has to do with the peer support that one gets by being a part of a group. Like-minded people getting together to help one another solve common problems really does work. Some group members who have progressed further along in their recovery can help pull along new arrivals and will mentor them until the new member can hold their own. The sponsor or buddy system approach appears to be the major factor in the success of such groups. However, it can sometimes also be a detriment to some members later on due to the dependence that can result. Such close bonds are often created that people can get into a symbiotic relationship where a member increasingly depends on a member or members of the group for advice and support to the point where they may jeopardize their independence and their opportunity for personal growth beyond the group. I've seen friends and clients become so embraced by a group that they find it very difficult to extricate themselves when they feel it's time to move on. Fortunately, this downside of the recovery and group support process doesn't happen all that often, I'm happy to say. But I think it reflects a reluctance that all of us who go through a spiritual growth process experience when we're faced at that time we call the dark night of the soul. We all abhor loneliness, and we yearn to have others to walk the path alongside us. But there comes a time when we must walk a stretch alone, no matter how hard we try to avoid it. People who are reluctant to face this truth may find themselves playing what I call recovery roulette. When they begin to feel smothered and decide that they want to leave their existing group, they may find it very difficult because they don't want to be cut off from their major source of support. Often, though, they do decide to try another different or maybe a similar group. It's still enticing and comforting to be welcomed into a new group and to feel the warmth and companionship once again. But I've known people to get stuck on their paths by repeatedly moving from group to group, seeking the perfect group affiliation, rather than facing the hard truth that such support is meant to be temporary and to provide a limited source of assistance. Until you're capable of fully taking care of your own emotional and spiritual growth. If you can avoid the downside of recovery self-help groups and refuse to play recovery roulette, you can certainly benefit from a limited time as a member of such a group. It is only if you come to crave their special kind of closeness and get so caught up in recovering that you're never fully recovered, that you could find yourself stalled out and faltering on your path. Remember, support and companionship are wonderful to have, but the spiritual journey is personal, and it is your relationship with yourself and your own soul that matters most, and you alone can create and nurture these. Finally, let's look at the path pothole that I call one-upmanship. One-upmanship is a spiritual or psychic game that can sometimes follow recovery roulette, or it can occur on its own. Having learned the ropes of the recovery process, a person can feel that they are now a mini expert on what does and doesn't work, at least for them. Some people will expound on the glories of 12-step programs, while others may swear by any number of other personal and spiritual growth programs that are available everywhere. And each person may be convinced that one or more of these techniques that work for them will work for almost anyone. And by the way, I do chuckle as I write this because I have my own favorite techniques and programs that I tout. It is common that after having secured our own spiritual salvation, we may become walking advertisements for our pet processes. It's just human, but not soul nature, to want to share with others our enthusiasm for something that has had such a profound effect on our own lives. Not only do we like to help others, we also find that it validates our own beliefs when others too come to share these beliefs with us. So once we experience a positive response from a workshop or a program, we often try to convince others that it's just what they too need in their lives. But what if the person we are attempting to evangelize has themselves found a different program that they believe in just as much as we believe in ours? Suddenly you may find yourself playing the game of one-upmanship with them, where each of you is trying to convince the other of the superiority of their program, workshop, or technique. Yes, but becomes an all-too-familiar phrase, as neither of you wants to admit there could be another path to enlightenment that you had not accessed. And horror of horrors, what if perchance you got it wrong and there could truly be another way that you have not yet tried? Are you now going to jump on this bandwagon as well and perhaps become what's known as a workshop junkie? Some of us, as finances allow, will indeed go this route. But the wiser among us will recognize that there's more than one road leading to Heaven's Gate. While there well may be a program, workshop, or technique that we have not yet run across that could be especially useful to us, we understand that many such sources of spiritual guidance are merely rearrangements of the old standbys that we've likely been exposed to in the past, or that we have access to in many different forms, oftentimes for free, if we just do a bit of research. We'd be wise to become more discerning consumers and save ourselves both time as well as money. I played the game of one-upmanship years ago without first realizing what I was doing when I was a speaker at a week-long conference for a spiritual fellowship foundation. One of the longtime members of a group that was leading a discussion about the channel self-material. I've never been a major fan of Seth, perhaps because I've never really given him or it much of a chance to win me over. I've always resonated more strongly with the Tibetan Buddhist Alice Bailey material. During our discussions, I found myself referring to the Alice Bailey books to make my points, while the discussion leader kept quoting Seth and Seth's book's author, Jane Roberts. Afterwards, he came up to me and quietly said, "You know, we could go back and forth all night with you quoting Alice Bailey and me quoting Seth, but we're really saying the same thing." He was right. The point is that each of us will, because of different personality and soul tendencies, resonate to various versions of spiritual truth. It's not so important where we get our spiritual information as long as it's a valid source, but simply that we do get it. By being more discerning and using our own intuitive judgment, we will gain confidence in our own ability to learn from and expand on the talents we already possess. One-upmanship then becomes a child's game that we no longer care to play. Secure in our own growth process, we neither need to convince others about our process, nor do we need to go on a never-ending quest for the perfect spiritual growth experience. These detours and potholes that we cover today are certainly not the only challenges that you may face as you traverse your spiritual path. In forthcoming podcasts, I will be describing other challenges as well as solutions to these challenges. But for now, this is a wrap. I thank you so much for listening today, and as always, feel free to contact me with questions, comments, or requests for resources at ritamilios@gmail.com. Remember, I'm always available for spiritual path coaching or for individual or group training for therapists and coaches. So to everyone who listened today, thanks again. I wish you always blessings on your path.